Welcome to Career Tools. Today's topic, how to read a book. Here we go.
Did I understand you correctly that you said this cast is about how to read a book? We're going to teach putting words together in syllables? Really? Reading? Reading? We're going back? We're going back to the future of reading?
Exactly.
Sorry. I couldn't resist that.
H-E.
Yeah. Phonetics. I remember phonetics.
The dog chases the cat. No, folks. Yeah. We're not going to teach you how to read a book. Most of us, maybe not you, Mark, but most of us were taught how to read nonfiction in school, right? We're taught how to critically review the arguments that were put forward by the author, how to analyze it for ourselves, how to determine whether or not the arguments made sense to us. Most of us got that. Now, some of us were never taught. Yeah.
I don't know about anybody else, but I will admit freely that when I was, quote, being taught how to read, I'm not really sure I thought of it that way. I thought of it as having to do an essay, and therefore I had to read a book and think about it. But more importantly, I just thought of that as classwork and schoolwork. I don't remember in 10th or 12th grade in high school or even in college years thinking critically about reading as a skill. I read constantly. I read more than anybody I knew. And yet I don't think I ever thought to myself, my teacher is teaching me how to think critically about a book. I knew I was thinking critically, but you know what I mean? And I certainly didn't think to myself when I started reading business books, aha, this is also nonfiction. I need to apply myself in the way I remember learning at school. I don't know.
I think at West Point we were taught to think critically. I think you're right. I didn't really think about it really.
Did I know I was learning?
Yeah.
I knew I learned how to think critically. Did I know I was being taught it precisely, pedagogically? No, I don't.
I'm sure we were taught and we were probably cognizant of what was going on to know what we're being taught. But I'll tell you what, I didn't really think about the importance of that until my professional career, until getting out of the Army. I mean, that's, you know, Minto's pyramid principle and books like that. I really took a great interest in improving my critical thinking.
Right. Yeah. And look, some books are so good when it comes to nonfiction about business, about our professional careers. It doesn't have to be about business. It could be a technical book. It could be an industrial book that's not really about business in terms of operations and so on, profit and loss and money and so on. You know, they're so good we want to try everything. And then we get overwhelmed and we don't do well. And a lot of times I think that's where you get flavor of the month from managers who read a book and say, I have power. I'm going to insist on this with my folks. And I'm sure that Manager Tools has been used as a cudgel before by managers. Ooh, I like this. It's doable. And at the same time, there's the other end of the spectrum, right? You read 10 or 15 books and you go, there's nothing here. Or you could be like me and read, say, 3,000 books and discover there's nothing there. A lot of wasted time.
Okay. So let's talk about the best way to get value from the books we buy, right? We buy a lot of books. We spend money. We spend much more in terms of time reading them than the $20 it costs us for the book. Boy, if we're going to spend that much time reading the book, then man, let's get something out of it.
Yeah. And anything I didn't learn in school about this, at least in terms of understanding the theory, I have since learned having to read so often and learning what works and what doesn't work in terms of processing the knowledge the book is giving you and determining whether or not it has value and then determining how to implement it and then paying attention to the results you get. That's really a form of application of the scientific principle, basically. So look, we have four recommendations. The first one is you've got to learn how to read with a critical mind. And we were joking a little bit earlier, folks. We do tend to have pretty critical minds here. Some of you might just say, well, Mark's just critical. The second thing you've got to do is take notes. You know, we get this all the time. I could go on a rant for an hour about notes. I won't do it. Handwritten notes really are the sine qua non of memory, and you've got to learn how to do it. It makes a huge difference in a book. Number three, you've got to be willing to highlight it or write in the margins. I dog-ear books, even though I know I've said it before that my mother would think that was a sin against the paper of the book, but I've checked and it doesn't have a soul, so I don't think I'm sinning against the book. And then lastly, you got to take action. That's the key, provided there is actionable material that you can justify taking action for.
Good. Okay, so we talked earlier about critical thinking skills and reading critically. So tell me, what does that mean, reading with a critical mind? What do you mean by that?
Well, this is my favorite sentence in this podcast. Just because someone got a book deal doesn't mean they have anything intelligent or reasonable to say.
That's true.
Just in case, folks, let me just say that again. Just because someone got a book deal doesn't mean they have anything intelligent or reasonable to say. In fact, you know, it's just the opposite in some cases. And look, obviously, the publishing business means a great deal to us. We love the wealth of knowledge that's available today. But the publishing business is part of media, the communication of information, and controversy sells. An unintelligent but controversial argument is more likely to get a book deal than a sensible, reasoned argument. When I told our friend Bill White, Professor White up at Kellogg, used to be the CEO of Bell & Howell, I told him, I have a book and I wanted him to look at it. He said he would. And then he says, what's the title? I said, The Effective Executive. And he just immediately, or The Effective Manager. And he just immediately went, oh, they'll make you change the title. Like, that was the first moment I thought, okay, we'll self-publish. I really like that title. But he said, look, my publisher wouldn't publish a book like that. That title won't get anybody's attention. When we read a book, we don't take what the author has said as being factual or true or even reasonable when it's a really controversial argument. It's really hard to pick up a book and knowing that the book may have been published for reasons different than we're reading it, to just accept. It would be silly just to accept the book. I tried doing that a long time ago. I tried just accepting, just suspending disbelief for a while. And for the really bad books, it was 10 pages in, and I thought, wow, they can twist anything in any way to convince anybody of anything here. Now, a lot of times it was my experience that was just bouncing up against this. And I suppose I missed some books that would have been good that I simply put down. Although for a long time, I think you and I have talked about this, for a long time, you and I insisted on finishing every book we started. Wasn't that true for you?
Yeah, that was absolutely true.
Yeah.
And oh, what a terrible habit.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a friend here in Fredericksburg who said I could never read a book twice because there are so many books. I just, you know, it'd be a waste. I could be reading a new book. There are a few books like Effective Executive. I think I'm on 15 or 16 reads. And there are some other books like The Natural and Field of Dreams, which actually wasn't named The Field of Dreams as a book. But I'd read those over and over and over again. But look, even serious business books, every author has an agenda. It may be that the achievement of his agenda doesn't get you what you want, doesn't allow you to achieve what you want. It may be that he's talking about a different age or a different industry. Sometimes, if you have a popular idea and your experience, perhaps as a consultant, we'll poke fun at ourselves a little bit, is based on one industry experience, and you want to talk about creativity that, let's say, Silicon Valley uses to create new software products or marketing software products, that may not apply to the steel industry or to the shoe industry or to marketing raw silk, for instance. And yet that could be a book that's popular and somebody'd say, hey, this is a good book about marketing. I think we ought to read it. And if you're not careful, you accept it. Hey, the guy got a book deal, so that must mean something. Not necessarily. And look, at the same time, we don't mean to contradict ourselves, but we're not saying that no book is ever right either. When folks write to us about things that they've read, we tend to hear one of two things from them. Either they totally fall in love with a book or an idea that's in a book and then contort everything to make what an entire book is right, right? Or they're determined to find nothing good and then contort their worldview to avoid any hint of something that's right in that. The truth is probably somewhere in the middle for books. We recommend you don't read a book expecting to agree with everything, even mine, when it comes out. Equally, don't expect to agree with nothing. You're not trying to disprove the book. You're trying to learn from the book. And we have some recommendations about how to think. When people tell you how to think, really what they're saying is, what questions ought you be asking? And here they are. As you're reading, ask yourself, if an idea is put forward as true in the book, then ask yourself, is the opposite of that idea untrue? Because saying something is true, is a truth, if you will, proves that the opposite is therefore untrue. And too often, authors, and I suspect podcasters too every once in a while, get excited and say, no, this is absolutely right. This is truth. This is from on high. And the fact is, that's not true when it comes to 99.9% of the material out there in the world. And suggesting something is an absolute, it makes it rare. Absolutes just are so rare as to be virtually impossible. So you have to be careful. When you hear that, and when you hear somebody suggesting something is true, then immediately ask if the opposite is untrue. When you find that it's not, the opposite is not untrue, then probably the first idea is not true to begin with. It may be serviceable. It may be interesting. It may be helpful. It may be rational. It may be something you want to do, but let's separate truth from effectiveness or truth from serviceability.
Yeah. What else?
Yeah, the next thing you've got to ask related to the truth bit, if an idea is put forward as true, is it always true?
It's almost always stated as being always true.
Yeah, the inductive reasoning creeps into books all the time. I saw this one example, so therefore this is a truth. And by the way, the reason it's true is because my example is so successful that, of course, it would work anywhere else. And I don't know that that's true. Well, look, Jim Collins' new book is coming out. I think we're going to interview him. And, you know, one of the things he talks about is the myth of X and Y and Z, that people say they see this thing happen and therefore they draw, they say, therefore this thing happened before it. And the data that he has says not true, not true at all. So be careful about that. Also, if an idea is put forward as true, you have to ask yourself, is it always true for every circumstance and every person? Again, drilling down a little bit further. Now, we're not suggesting you're looking for a reason to say no to the idea. We're asking you to think critically around putting boundaries around the idea and understanding the scope and the magnitude of the idea. If it's put forward as true, look, we give the author a little bit of slack and say, yeah, a little bit of puffery is okay. But we want to separate out the puffery and ask ourselves, to what extent is this really helpful? Let's take truth off the table. How much is it helpful and how much of it might just be puffery? And then the last question is, if it's put forward as true, is it true for you as well? Based on your experience, based on your situation, based on your context. I wish that I could go back through all the books I've ever read and absolutely have a list in front of me of the number of times I read a book and said, this isn't true for me now, but this book is over my head, or this book was written for me in the future, or I'm not an executive yet, or I've never been in that industry, but I know I will someday. And I said to myself, I got to remember this. And then one of Horseman's laws, if Horseman says, I got to remember this, it ain't getting remembered. It's dead. If I write it down, it gets remembered every single time. Unless you lose a notebook with like 50 podcast ideas in it, then, well, they come back to you, but you don't remember them coming back to you.
OmniFocus, yeah. Man. OmniFocus, but okay.
Yeah.
I've been trying to tell you. You won't listen.
I'm looking forward to voice memos. Yeah. OmniFocus, you're right.
Have you read anything recently from any author as an example of something where you applied some critical thinking? I just think of maybe an example of something you've read recently and some questions you went through in terms of evaluating what it
sure.
was said.
I'll tell you what, I'll give you the best example I know of, which is Effective Executive. I get different truths and ideas out of it every time based on my context. When I compare my dog-eared pages, different things are highlighted. Now, I'm not saying that any one of those things is always true or one of them is not true. If I underline the second sentence and the second paragraph on page 25 one time, and then I later, two readings later, underline the fourth sentence in the second paragraph on page 25, what is that about? What that's about is that's what struck me at the time, and that goes to the issue of, is it true for me? Now, I tend to read Peter Drucker more critically now than I did 25, 30 years ago. But I also admit I'm not as critical because every time I've read it, it continues to be the book that has more density of genius of any book I've ever read. So that is one. I read a book recently. I don't want to be too negative about any one particular book. I read a book called The Responsibility Virus, and I found it not effective at all. Seth Godin wrote in his book Lynchpin, and I like Seth Godin. I think he would probably be fairly dismissive of me pretty quickly. I think I'm pretty rational. I think he's pretty emotional, but he clearly is very smart about a lot of things. I've read a lot of his books and loved them. You know, he wrote in Lynchpin, he wrote, given the chance, you should choose to be indispensable. After all, if you're the linchpin, the company has to treat you better. They have to pay you fairly. You won't be the first to be shown the door in a slow period. In fact, you'll be the last. Well, look, folks, if you examine that idea critically, I mean, I love that, but to me, that's career puffery. Okay. I'm trying to remember the context of that quote, but I can only assume he went on to say, so you have to put up better results than everybody else and keep your relationship strong. Yeah, well, we've been saying that for a few years now. But look, that idea is not really convincing when you examine it critically. Now, look, Seth Godin might say indispensable is not what you – I don't mean what you think I mean. But separate from that, is the opposite of his idea true? Are people who are not indispensable amongst those who keep their jobs in slow period? In our experience, yes. In every reduction in force that we've seen, there's someone about whom it said, I don't know why they kept her. She's useless. Right? So there are plenty of people who aren't indispensable who do make it. Is his idea always true? Nope. There are hundreds of thousands of indispensable secretaries and assistants who've been let go in the last 30 years. They're the keepers of all kinds of, you know, corporate institutional memory. People who've been with the company for years and years and years, they have enormous goodwill and they make other people's goodwill even more powerful, and they get cut. And it just infuriates me. Is the idea always true for every circumstance and every person? Heavens no, of course it's not. Having specific and specialized knowledge doesn't always make somebody valuable to a company. We bet if you polled every worker in America, 95% would say they're not paid what they think they're worth. Actually, I think it's closer to like 100%. I think it's marginally 100%, in fact. Pay and skills and value are seen differently by individuals versus companies. And that's the nature of the dynamic tension and the conflict that exists in the workplace. And is this idea true for you? Well, it's certainly not true for us. It's not true for Mike or I or Wendy or Maggie. So the question is it true for you? It may in fact be. Now, you could argue that if you're indispensable, you're less likely. And I think that's, you know, less likely to get the axe. I think that's an absolutely reasonable argument. And then you could say, well, that's what he meant. And there was puffery involved. Okay, fine. I'm okay with that. But I think we have to be careful in terms of giving everyone a pass when we read, because this is supposed to be a critically put together, thoughtful recommendation. It's going out to tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, particularly potentially millions of people.
Right. Well, and if you're reading it critically, you have to acknowledge that it is, in fact, puffery, right? But if you're not thinking critically, you're not reading critically, it's easy just to hear the statement, not accept it as true and move on. So,
yeah. And I think a lot of times, marketing people, in my experience, are more quick to do flavor of the month, in part because they get excited about things, in part because marketing books are written by marketing people who make it exciting. You know, I have to tell you, one of the reasons I love The Goal by Eli Goldratt, who, you know, passed away this year, is because it was a story about engineering and operations. And it was so rare to have a story that involved me, that taught me something about operations in an organization, that it was just a stunning moment reading it. I've said before on air, I think, I get choked up every time I read it. And I think sometimes if you're a marketing person or if you're reading a marketing book and it sounds too good to be true, well, it may not be too good to be true, but it probably is. And some of that is the tone of voice it's being delivered with. Look, you need to be able to examine things critically because it all started with an idea. We want you to read books critically, and we want you to understand that not everything you read is true. And we supported that argument with different circumstances where what you read may or may not be true. If the idea we're sharing with you isn't supportable or true for you, then taking the action won't get you the result you want. And you don't have time to read every book, believe every word, and then do everything, and then find yourself getting frustrated. You'll become soured and cynical to the idea of management development or professional development in any way. So you've got to read critically. You've got to ask yourself those questions. Is it true? Is the opposite untrue? Is it true always? Is it true in every circumstance? Is it true for me? And it's not hard. And the first time you do this, it's like I tell people at conferences, the first time you do something, you're going to stink at it. It's going to slow you down. And then you do it four or five times with books, and suddenly it becomes second nature. And you'll catch yourself reading the fifth or sixth book you've been reading lately, and you'll catch yourself in the back of your head, a voice will be saying to you, well, that's not true. And that's the moment. Thinking critically has now become the way you ingest words in a book, by asking yourself these questions. Is it always true? Is the opposite untrue? And so on. Those are the questions to ask. This is Career Tools. We teach you exactly what to do. We're not saying we're perfect. There may, in fact, be a better way. And if we know it, we'll share it with you. But we know if you want to read a lot of books and you want to develop yourself, you've got to learn to think critically. Otherwise, you're in danger of choosing to do things and wasting your effort that aren't going to be effective. We know that you've got to be able to think critically. And this is the way to think critically. These are the questions to ask. And after you've done it five or six times, it disappears. You don't ask those questions anymore by moving your lips when you're reading the book. I remember I do that when I'm really going through a hard, difficult paragraph. I'll actually almost say the words out loud, like, that doesn't make sense to me. And usually it's because I've missed a comma or I have a syllable. I have a word emphasized in the wrong way. I don't understand a subordinate clause or something like that. But when you start doing it and then you're reading a paragraph and you say to yourself all of a sudden, that's not true. Whereas maybe 10 years before, this is particularly important for you guys who are younger. Before, you would have just read it and been, oh, I'm okay with that, or that's fine, or that's what this person says. And then you suddenly realize, well, that's not true. And then you go, aha, okay, now it's happened. And you've learned a skill that you will have with you for the rest of your life. Now, many of you may already have it. And if you do, good for you. That's great. But that sense of that's not true will come much more quickly if you learn to ask the right questions over and over again. Practice asking those questions as each new idea is presented in a book. And you'll discover that you'll filter out the things that don't work for you. One of my bosses once said, Mark, reading a good book is like interviewing the book. You're looking for reasons to say no to the book. If you get to the end of the book and you can't find any reason why what the book says doesn't make sense, then because you've been trying so hard the whole time to say no, you believe you've probably got a yes on your hand if you've gotten to the end of the book and you haven't found a reason to say no. That's what interviewing is, right? You look for a reason to say no. If you can't find a reason to say no, maybe this person's a yes. And then you talk to them again and see whether or not they really are a yes. But I love that. He says, I just interview books. That's what I do. I read them. I'm constantly asking, does that make sense? Is that true? Does that fit? Is that right for me? If I get to the end and I haven't disproven it, okay, maybe I'll read it again and really dig through it. Or I'll go back and read the chapter that really gets to action and I'll action that part. Yeah. One of the most valuable lessons I ever learned. And that's, by the way, when I started saying 20 pages into a book, no way. This is awful. And what's more, I add another criteria on top of it, which is the book is really poorly written. I'm not going to read it. Now, some of you would say, oh, Mark, I wish you wouldn't do that. There are some really wonderful ideas in the world that are poorly written. And I would say, yes, you're right. And my filters are not perfect. I'm as flawed as anybody else. And that's one of my filters. And I'm sticking to it because if I'm going to read 200 business books a year, I'm not going to get there this year. I think I'm 150 or something. If I'm going to read that many, I'm going to choose not to be miserable.
Right.
I just won't do it.
Let's talk about the difference that I see, not only on my bookshelf, yours takes it to another level. And that's if I go to your bookshelf and I pull out a book, it doesn't matter which book, there is writing all over the book. You know, frankly, particularly for people of our generation, right? We're 50, right?
Yeah.
Libraries were a big part of our reading experience, right? That's where we got books. Maybe when you're younger, you were able to buy a lot of books. I was not.
No, we went to the public library.
We went to the public library all the time, and you could not write in them. So I grew up for a long time. I had this reverence around books, and I love books. And even if I bought it as my book, you just did not write in it. And at some point in my career, I stopped that. I got out of that habit. But,
right.
But you have a lot of writing in your books.
Yeah, dude, all of your books are written in because I gave them all to you and they're all inscribed to Mike, the best guy ever.
There you go. That's what I meant.
Yeah, that's what you meant, exactly. Yeah, look, I didn't realize the extent. I was raised the same way you were. And look, by the way, if you're younger than us, if you know, it's 2011 as we're recording this, if you're 20 or 25 and you didn't learn this, and so you were able to write in books, good for you. We're not saying that the way we were raised was better. We have since learned that in terms of the ingestion and the use of knowledge, which is why one reads, it's better to interact with the book. It's better to take notes. And the reverence with which you approach a physical book, nothing wrong with that for first editions or first printings or anything by John McDonald or Peter Drucker. That reverence probably doesn't serve the world and yourself very well. And you know me, Mike, I think a few years ago I told you, I can't imagine not having books in every room of my house. And yet, if you come to my office now, there's almost no books in my office because they're all on the Kindle app on my iPad. And I really have started thinking, what does that mean? But what I've learned is I take notes in my notebook when I'm reading a book on my iPad, and then I transfer them much more effectively. A lot of times the notes that are in the book stay in the book. I've shown many groups that I've presented to. I've opened up Effective Executive and flipped through it, and people want to come up and look at it, and they say, my gosh, I thought you said you'd read this a lot. I said, yeah, it's still good. Yeah, by the way, we should call this the ad for the Effective Executive, right? This podcast. Yeah, look, as you read a book, the only way to truly get as much out of it as you possibly can, no matter whether you're kinesthetic or auditory or whatever those learning styles are, the most effective way to learn is to take notes. Notes help you remember the ideas in a book more easily. You physically have to do something that jars your memory. You create a picture. The writing that you do in the margins is so different from typing, I can't even describe it. It's the difference, as Jimmy Buffett once said, between a lightning and a lightning bug. You know, words matter, but just three letters can make an enormous difference. In fact, when Wendy tried to remember the quote from Seth Godin's book when she was writing this guy, she could remember it only being early in the book on a left-hand page near the bottom, and she had read it on a train. The way memory is set up is not always helpful as we ingest what's in a book. We can encourage our brain to remember things more easily and remember the right things by taking notes. And I will tell you something else is really important to me. Notes help synthesize ideas. Ideas by themselves are generally not useful on their own. The idea itself might be inspirational or might help you think, but the idea itself is not worth a lot. Please, guys, don't send me bad emails. I know what I mean here, and I know it sounds awful, but the issue is putting it into action, right? The Greek philosopher who asked, is a thing's kind the most general one or the most specific one? It's interesting, but it's not necessarily helpful. But if you apply it specifically to management, it becomes much more useful. Is the kind of person on our team the most general or the most specific? In other words, should we think of the people in our teams as people, the most general, or should we think of them as a 40-ish-year-old white male American with no children? Which works better to help you manage them? We're not going to go down the rabbit hole here. It's, you know, we're not talking about that specific idea, but it's the application of the idea and turning it into giving it context and form and meaning in your situation, as it goes back to asking those questions we talked about earlier and learning to think critically or reading critically. It's the application of the idea and the movement of the idea into your life that becomes important. And when you write something down, you break the flow of just letting the words flow over you. All of us have had the experience. Let me take that back. I'm sure there are a few people who have not had the experience because they struggle because of the way their brains are wired with reading easily. I know for some people, reading is very hard, and we certainly respect that it's hard for you. But for many of us, reading, you've read a couple of paragraphs or maybe even a couple of pages, and the words have been flowing over you, and you know what you're reading about, but you can't remember anything critically at all because you're letting it flow over you. You're finishing the book, but you're not learning from the book at that moment when it's flowing over you. So what you've got to do is interact with the book a little bit more and be asking, is this true? Is it not true? Okay, should I write that down? Should I not write that down? And if I write it down, what do I really want to write down? I can circle it and go, wow, or I could say, what does this mean for me? Or could this mean X? What about me doing Y, for instance? When we're reading, we often have an idea about how what's being written about relates to a client or a member or a podcast. I can't tell you the number of times I've put an arrow to the side and said GE or P&G or Apple or whatever. Scribbles in the margin, things like coaches, certified, manager tools, right? Might not make any sense to anybody else or maybe even us days later. Folks, I promise you, 20% of the scribbles I've written down are worthless to me a year later. On the other hand, that is a much lower percentage than the number of things that are worthless to me that I never wrote down at all. If you write them next to a page number and a book title in a notebook, though, the idea is going to come back to you, right? If I write in a notebook while I'm reading on my iPad and I write EE for Effective Executive, page 52, coaches, ? That's easy for me to figure out the context of that. And the application of that paragraph or that reference to our business, to why we read in some cases, is what's important. So you've got to write. Now, look, you could take notes on the side. We're going to talk here in a minute about writing in the margins. What we're getting at, again, is interact, interview, the book. If you allow the book to happen to you, it's as if you're back in school and you have to finish the book, and then you'll make up something to write an essay about. In order to think critically, you have to poke at the book. You have to interact with it. When the ideas are presented, you can't just hear them said by someone else. You have to stand, put them on a table in front of you, and walk around them and look at them for a second. Now, the first 5-10 times you do this, it's going to slow your reading down. After that, you'll get so good at it, it won't slow you down anymore, but now you'll avoid implementing all kinds of ideas you don't want, and you'll capture the ones that are really going to be life-changing because you'll be poking at them and realize, wow, this idea is, I didn't know it was true or not, but now I'm realizing it's totally bulletproof and maybe I ought to be doing something with it.
Okay, so taking notes is important, but when I was referring to your books, I referred to something different than you just taking notes, but you're taking notes in the margins. I mean, your books are written all over the place, not just highlighted, but written all over the place, particularly the margins.
Yeah, in fact, you can highlight in a Kindle as well, and you can actually have flashcards created from your highlights. I've always wondered a little bit about having to see other people's highlights. I know this makes me a really bad person, and I'm really sorry. I hope that we give away everything we know for free, balances out the fact that sometimes I admit to being a bad person. But I really don't want to see anybody else's highlights in a book I'm reading. I'm amazed at the number of things people highlight. I'm going, that ain't the important part of that paragraph, folks. Who wrote that? I don't know what the algorithm is to determine what gets highlighted and what doesn't. But sometimes I read a paragraph and go, why would anybody highlight that? I guess in their context, it was important. But I think a certain number have to highlight it for it to make the cut such that I have to read it highlighted in my book. No, thank you. In a way, I guess that's how I think of the book as being sacrosanct. Nobody else gets to write it in my book.
But that doesn't bother me as much as it bothers you. Matter of fact, doesn't bother me at all.
Okay. Maybe it doesn't really bother me, but my eyebrow goes. If I could raise an eyebrow, my eyebrow would raise. Writing on the book helps you engage with the text, helps you understand it more fully, makes it become more real for you. You can throw some things in the bowl and stir it, or you can knead the dough. And if you want really great ideas, if you're really willing to put your passion behind something, you better make sure it works every which way from Sunday. And that means kneading the dough. That means really, really writing in the margins. I mean, I've written notes before and then went, oh, nope, thought I had a great idea. That won't work. Scribble that out. And it took an extra 5 or 10 seconds. I'll never forget that page. I can tell you exactly what I wrote underneath the scribble that I scribbled it out. And I can tell you why I thought the way I thought. And largely, by the way, it's because of the visual representation of my note, not the actual letters that I wrote, but where I wrote them and the shape of the letters. And folks, do better than me, please, because I write really fast and I often write scribbly and chicken scratchy, and I can't read my notes sometimes. So please do better than me. When you write in a book, and I am saying that, when you write in a book, someone forward this to my mother and she'll send me a note. When you write in a book, make sure you can read it. Do better than I do.
Good. Okay. And then the last part, actually doing something with it, taking action, right? That's part of it. When you take notes, like just marking idea in the margins or whatever, put a special symbol around it, and an A with a circle around it would probably work, right? But you could choose something else. But as you're reading the book, decide, as you see something interesting, make a decision to do something with it.
Yeah. Here's, in fact, what I've learned. I've learned that when I decide, when I've got an idea, I used to tell myself, I'm going to take notes in this entire book, and then when I go back through, I have no evidence that I can do that. I have no evidence. There may be people who are better at it than me. And the only reason I'm not recommending this is I've never met someone who says, oh, after I read a book and take notes and everything, I go back through in detail and determine, okay, now, which one of these ideas am I going to do? Which ones are going to be put on hold that I can remember to later? I've never met anyone who
I've told myself that story many, many times reading a book. And you're right. I've never gone back and actually done
it. And we recommend actionable things. And I just simply don't believe that's actionable. Now, Keith Ferrazzi in his book, Never Eat Alone, talks about it's not Keith Ferrazzi. It may be. He talks about how to take notes, and he talks about writing all over the book. And then I think he talks about going back through. So he may be somebody who goes back through. The number of books I'm reading and the general paucity of good books is such that I never find myself going back through because I'm ready to move on to the next book. So we don't recommend that. But what I can say is I've learned this lesson the hard way. When I think of something that's actionable, as I'm reading a paragraph, even if I'm behind in the book, if I read an idea that is truthful, that is helpful, that is contextually valuable for me, that makes sense to me once I examine it critically and poke at it and interview it and discover that it's not, the opposite is not false and all those kind of things. And I say, okay, this idea has some running shoes on. I can make it work. How am I going to action it? I stop reading at that moment and I essentially come up with, okay, what am I going to do? How am I going to action this? And so on. It might be an email to Wendy. It might be an email to you. It might be, okay, I'm going to send a note to a client. I was just reading something. I want to talk to you about it next week. And I take action as quickly as I can. And generally speaking, if something gets written down in my notebook, it's going to be reviewed many, many, many times, particularly if it has an A. I happen to use A's and circles for this is something that needs to be actionable. If we hired somebody named Alan, it could be a problem because I always circle people's first names, first initial in note-taking. But if something's actionable, I put an A with a circle around it. And then I actually make a plan or at least take one action, even if it's just sending a text message or an email saying, I want to talk to you about X. I have not learned a better way. I know if I say, boy, this book was full of ideas and a lot of them are actionable. If I finish the book, folks, you may be different than me. You may want to go back through. You may be able to go back through. I've never met anybody who does that. If you are, please write and tell us. And then we'll say, okay, there are people who think it's actionable. I just don't believe the vast majority of people are going to go back through every book and then make a list of the actionable things and do it. I just don't think it makes any sense. And there are people who tell us, well, I don't actually read a book to action anything. I'm just trying to learn. And I'm hoping that there's a synergy that happens after the 10th or 15th book that in the right context, my brain will remember all that stuff. And that's completely fine, folks. We're okay with that. We're not suggesting every book you read should be full of chock-a-block of 25 different actions. It may be just one every two or three books. But when you read something that is actionable, we do recommend you stop. And if there are two or three ideas, we recommend you choose one and only one and implement it. Look, and if there are none, good. The action to take when you read a book that doesn't give you any good ideas is to do nothing and to remind yourself that you learned something about what not to do, and you're not stupid enough to visit that on somebody simply because you wouldn't want to have wasted your time and not taken any action for it. Let's be discerning. Let's not just be taking lots of action. And I've also found it's generally better to choose an actionable item that has less effect on other people. In other words, choose something that will affect you or that will change you or that will make you more effective and roll it out for yourself before you start thinking about implementing it across the organization or across everybody else. If you read Execution by Larry Bossidy, which continues to just be, I'm going to start reading that book as well every year. The book is just so detailed. I love the high level and the low level together. It's that good, folks. His first two essential behaviors, Larry Bossidy's first two essential behaviors are know your people in your business and insist on realism. One of those actions doesn't impact other people. You can learn about the people you work with and your business without causing too much of a stir. Yeah, people will have to answer questions for you, right? So for you to learn about them. But if you ask somebody at the water cooler, what football team do you support? They won't think that you're trying to implement some new plan that's going to be a pain for them. But if you start insisting on realism in meetings, exposing mistakes, being confrontational, calling people out for grandiose ideas that can never be implemented, now you might have a problem, you know, particularly if you don't do it with gentleness or with respect. So it's far better to choose an actionable item that is largely impacted on you or that largely impacts or affects you. Now, if you've done three or four and you feel like you can roll out something that affects other people, great, that's fine. Build the relationships first. And then later, maybe you could insist on realism, to use Bossidy's example. You know, implement one idea from a book. And once it's solid ground underneath your feet and you feel confident that it's part of how you act, move on to the next one. Please don't try and change everything all at once. Mike and I tried that with the Trinity by putting out all the ideas all at once.
That worked well. People
writing us and saying, gee, I'm really struggling with this. Oh, yeah, we forgot to tell you that you can't do all this stuff all at once. They're all really, really powerful ideas. And you can't overnight change everything. You can't be driving down the road in your car and change the tires and the engine at the same time. You have to pull in, stop, take your time, change the tires, then later change the engine and so on. If you think critically, if you take notes, if you write in the margins, and when you take action, you plan a little bit and you focus narrowly on yourself to begin with to be sure what you're doing is right. I'm quoting now from Charles Sewell's book, Customers for Life, where he says, make a little, sell a little. He says, look, before we try something across the entire dealership, we make a small batch to see whether or not it works. And we try it. And if we make good money with it, we'll do more. But we don't fundamentally revamp things just because of some really, really great idea. Beware people coming around saying, I've got a really, really great idea. If they don't have examples of it being put into effect with notably great, really, really great results, then really, maybe they're just really, really excited about it. Or they're just really, really, really good looking. So be careful about that. And critical thinking will cause you to want to implement less. But when you choose to implement something, make sure you start with yourself as well. Oh, one more thing. It's the hidden number five that I should have talked about at the beginning. You could ignore all this if you just read more. That's the subtext of this. Reading more is better. I think I've said this a few times at conferences. He who can read and doesn't distinguishes himself not at all from he who cannot read at all to begin with. What a great gift to know how to read. Yeah. What a terrible throwing away of the gift to then not read. And by the way, we don't mean airline magazines.
There you go.
So read with a critical mind, take notes, write in the book. It's okay. Get over your reverence. If you really are still reverent, we understand, but you got to take notes while you're reading the book somewhere else. And then when you take action, take it one step at a time and start with yourself. Everybody talks about how great reading is. Charlie Tremendous Jones says, you're the same today as you'll be in 5 years, except for the people you meet and the books you read. And then if you could add to that and take action upon. Read, read critically, take notes, take action. Become better, make the world a better place. We'd like that.
Yeah, I would. All right. Thanks, my friend.
You bet, partner.
Bye. Thanks, everyone. That's it. We'll see you next week. In the meantime, have a great one. So long.